Down to Business. Sponsored by Flowgas. On the grid, off the grid. Flowgas is Ireland's only supplier of LPG and natural gas. Wherever you are.
Morning, everybody. Just to set the scene for you, I'm here in Stanford University in Palo Alto, just outside San Francisco. I'm in a really cool place called the D School. And even cooler, I'm in a 1951 Chevrolet. It's part of the design school. It's a 1951 van, kitted out with bean bags, rugs, and it's a place where people think about design. And I'm here with my next guest, who's Mr. Stuart Coulson. He's a North Dublin man who's been working in Stanford University for a long, long time. He works in the business school, but his subject matter is design thinking. Stuart Coulson, you're so welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
Now, Stuart, I haven't sat cross-legged in a kind of a van with bean bags and stuff for quite a while.
Welcome to the D School.
Tell me, I suppose, we'll start maybe with Stanford University.
Sure. So Stanford is a private university. It was founded in 1891, which is pretty old by West Coast US standards. It's takes about 17,000 students. About half of them are graduates and half undergrads. And it's been very successful. Obviously, it's considered part of the heritage and part of the history of Silicon Valley in terms of the engineers and the computer scientists that it produces, the faculty that it has on board. At the moment, I believe there are 20 Nobel laureates on staff in Stanford, which is a pretty amazing thing.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, and I suppose it is reflective of the cost of education in America, the typical bill here for a fee-paying student would be circa $67,000, $70,000 per annum, including accommodation. That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. It's a private university, and a lot of the universities charge significant amounts of money. One of the things that Stanford does to try and allay that is they have a very significant financial aid program. And so any family whose income is less than $100,000 a year, whose child or student gets accepted to Stanford, gets a free ride education as part of the financial support. And many other students will get partial support as well. But people still significantly leave college with large student debt, which is one of the things that happens here in the US quite a lot.
Okay, let's talk about you yourself, Stuart Coulson. You're a Glasnevin man. How did you find your way to Stanford?
By a very circuitous route. So I did computer science in Trinity in the 1980s, which no good reason why I chose that, but it turned out to be a good career move. And then I spent the next 20-something years working on data communications, financial systems, military systems, and I ended up in the airline space. And so I worked in airline reservations for a long time. And during that time, I tried to form some companies. They probably weren't called startups at the time. But eventually, I hit an idea of using the internet to book airline tickets, which was something that was happening a lot. And so my company, Gradient Solutions, that I co-founded, we provided the technology that sat behind a lot of the airline systems.
Okay, so you were an entrepreneur yourself. As you say, you had maybe, and again, it's probably fairly typical of lots of entrepreneurs, you had one that landed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Exactly. No pun intended.
Right. Okay, and then what about the academia then? How did you, did you drift into that, or was it something that started part-time? Or
I'd love to tell you I had a master plan, but I did not. I was here in Palo Alto. I now do investing in early stage tech companies, and I wanted my philanthropic role, whatever that was, to have the same kind of operation in terms of being able to invest or to help companies that are organizations that were working in a business-like manner. And a couple of the companies that I started to look at had emerged from this class at Stanford called Design for Extreme Affordability. So about 10 years ago, I started pestering the teaching team to get involved because I wanted to make sure I got all the deal flow. And as a result of that, I was asked, would I like to coach? And then I was asked, would I like to teach? And here I am 10 years later, an adjunct professor, and I have no idea how it happened.
Okay, well, that's a pretty decent story of academia and your path into it. And you're also a winemaker. Tell us about that.
So I'm not a winemaker. I'm a grape grower. And okay. So I have a vineyard up in the Russian River Valley, an old vine, Zinfandel vineyard, which some other clever people turned the grapes into some pretty good wine.
And is that all-consuming in terms of... are you able to balance that with your role in academia?
I am. So I could get more involved. I have a farm manager and people who look after the business. So sometimes I joke that I do most of my farming by email and Excel spreadsheet. But I do get involved. It's a nice little business to understand and to know. And in fact, in a strange way, it reminds me of the software industry in Ireland in the 1980s and 90s. It's a very insular little group of people. They all know each other. They all came from the same college courses.
Okay.
They all wheel and deal with each other and steal each other's employees. It's good fun to be in the business.
Okay, and one of the things, we were up in the Napa Valley yesterday looking at what a beautiful place it is, and we were in a vineyard. I'm still slightly perplexed about the cost per bottle of wine in California. Could you give me your thinking on why it is? Is it a taxation thing? Is it down to property values? What do you see? What's your own take on it?
So I think it's a regional thing. Certainly, Napa Valley is the most expensive vineyard land in the state, in the country, in fact. And it's as a result, there's a lot of very high end wines come from Napa. My vineyard is in Sonoma, which is the next valley across. It's in the Russian River Valley, and so prices are a little bit more reasonable there, but it's still a lot of niche product. Both of Napa and Sonoma vineyards are quite small. And so there's not that much land that can be used, and therefore that pumps the prices up a lot.
Okay, interesting. Really interesting. Now, let's get down to design thinking. We had a fascinating delivery from yourself this morning about the process. Firstly, maybe for the uneducated amongst us, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but the ones... explain design thinking to us.
So design thinking is a series of tools and methodologies that allows you to be creative at will. So instead of having to wait for an accident or a eureka moment to come along where you can innovate and you're not quite sure where that idea comes from, this gives you a process, a method by which you can understand what's needed and then deliver a useful solution for that. It turns the regular innovation process really on its head. Another name for design thinking is human-centered design, and the idea is that you are not designing for yourself or for your own experience or background. You're designing specifically for another audience. And so you have to understand that audience really well so that you can pose the right problem so that you can then develop the right solution. So it turns the whole thing upside down.
So it's the opposite to actually having an idea, picking a product, designing a prototype, bringing it to somebody. Do you like this? Will you sell? It's actually working completely the other way around.
Yeah. So you work on that. You talk to users first. You spend a lot of time deciding what the problem is. A lot of the Silicon Valley companies around here, they're used to what they call pivoting. So they work on something, it doesn't work, and then they take their VC's money and they start to work on something else. And a pivot is not really a problem of not finding the right solution. It's mostly in terms of not working on the right problem. And so design thinking asks you to spend a lot of time and effort working on the problem first. Then you get to the solution. And through that entire process, you are rapid prototyping and testing with users constantly. So you're not investing 6 months into your beta before the first time somebody sees it and tells you it's no good.
Okay. No, I think I get it. So what you might do, Stuart, is just maybe tell us, give us some good examples of practical design thinking.
Sure. So in the class that I teach, Design for Extreme Affordability, we set up student teams to work on products and services for the developing world to alleviate poverty. And so first of all, instant design thinking in that these students are not familiar with the markets they're going to work in. They have to do a lot of empathy and understand the people that they're going to work for before they can work on them. And they end up developing really interesting projects. We've run 130 projects so far in the class, of which 35, 36 are in operation. And they run the gambit. We do a lot of work with small plot farmers. So we've had drip irrigation companies, water pumping companies. We've had one of our more famous products is called the Embrace Baby Incubator, which is a low-cost incubator for premature babies that doesn't require electricity. And so it uses hot water as a method to maintain the baby's body temperature.
Fascinating stuff. Well, listen, thanks very much for a very entertaining and educational tour of the design school here at Stanford University. It's great to meet a Dublin man who's come so far and kind of does things a bit left of field, which is growing grapes, teaching in design schools. Thank you. You're an interesting character. And thanks also, Stuart, for conducting this interview in the back of a 1951 Chevrolet. It's probably been a first and probably a last for me, but it's been very, very inspirational, let's call it.
Welcome to Northern California.
Down to Business. Sponsored by Flowgas. On the grid, off the grid. Flowgas is Ireland's only supplier of LPG and natural gas. Wherever you are.